My guest on Fresh Air is comic Graham Chapman. Chapman was a founding member of Monty Python's Flying Circus, the six-man British comedy group which broke up audiences at home and abroad with their performances on TV, films, and records.
Not this record! Not this record! Not this record!
Chapman starred in two Monty Python films. He played King Arthur in Monty Python and the Holy Grail and Brian in the biblical epic, The Life of Brian. On their TV shows and records, Chapman played a variety of roles, from the stuffy civil servant to the old biddy to the straight man who would come in to force the sketch to conclude.
Stop that! It's silly. Very silly indeed.
The Pythons created a comic style based on surrealistic wordplay, and Chapman was memorable in some of the troupe's classic sketches.
I'd like to have an argument, please.
Certainly, sir. Have you been here before?
No, I haven't. This is my first time.
I see. Well, do you want to have just one argument, or were you thinking of taking a course?
Well, what is the cost?
Well, it's £1 for a 5-minute argument, but only £8 for a course of 10.
Well, I think it would be best if I perhaps started off with just the one and then see how it goes.
Fine. Well, I'll see who's free at the moment. Mr. DeBakey's free, but he's a little bit conciliatory. Ah, yes. Try Mr. Barnard, room 12.
Thank you.
What do you want?
Well, I was told outside that...
Don't give me that, you snotty-faced heap of parrot droppings!
What?
Shut your festering gob, you tit! Your type really makes me puke, you vacuous, toffee-nosed, malodorous pervert!
Look, I came here for an argument. I'm not going to just...
I'm sorry, but this is abuse.
Oh, I see. Well, that explains...
Yes. You want room 12A, just along the corridor.
Oh, thank you very much. Sorry.
Not at all.
Thank you.
Stupid git.
That was Chapman dishing out the abuse. In addition to being an inspired comic writer and actor, Chapman is a trained physician, a gay rights activist, and a recovering alcoholic. If you've lost track of him since the Pythons broke up, he's been a stand-up comic, a lecturer, author, and film producer. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Let's talk about the kinds of parts that you played in Monty Python. I think it was a pretty wide range.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it was fairly.
Did your physical, you're very tall, first or second tallest in the group? Did
the
your physical
second
traits,
tallest, yes.
John, did that determine?
John is about, he's 6 foot five. I'm just under 6 foot four. So, yes, he's got me by an inch.
Did your height determine what kind of roles you played?
Well, it did in a way, because John and I tended to get the authority roles, I suppose, because it was simpler to play the authority figures as being larger than the people who bore the brunt of their activities. So, yes, that did affect casting quite a bit. Mm.
You played the civil servant a lot and the colonel mm-hmm. role a lot. What kind of accent would you have to do for people in positions like that?
Pretty middle-of-the-road BBC English, really, I suppose.
Which is?
Well, it's more or less as the colonel spoke, you know. So not too heavy a regional accent, no particular region attached to it. It's sort of like the supposedly the Queen's English, I suppose.
Can you do the difference between a working class civil servant and upper class English accent? You've got them all down?
Well, yes, of various kinds. I mean, there are different accents within those groups as well, really. And England is a very small place, but there are an enormous number of accents within that place.
You've done the old biddy type role. Let's listen to an example of that, and
okay.
We'll talk about how this voice came to be. And this is Monty Python's Flying Circus.
Hello, Mrs. Premise.
Oh, hello, Mrs. Conclusion.
Busy day?
Busy. I just spent 4 hours burying the cat.
4 hours to bury the cat?
Yes, I wouldn't keep still, wriggling about, howling.
Oh, it's not dead then?
Oh, no, but it's not at all a well cat. And as we're going away for a fortnight, I thought I'd better bury it just to be on the safe side.
Right. You don't want to come back from Sorrento to a dead cat, do you?
Yes.
We've decided to have the budgie put down.
Oh, is he very old then?
No, we just don't like it.
Oh, how do they put budgies down?
Well, it's funny you should ask that. I've been reading a great big book on how to put your budgie down. And evidently you can either hit them with the book, or you can shoot them there just above the beak.
Mrs. Essence flushed hers down the loo.
Oh, that's dangerous, because they breed in the sewers, and eventually you get huge, evil-smelling flocks of soiled budgies flying out of people's lavatories, infringing their personal freedom.
Now, Graham Chapman, you're the one with the budgie in that sketch.
That's right, yes, with the budgie with the problem. Yes, well, suppose they originated those kind of characters. I hesitate to call them women or ladies because they were too grotesque to be called that, in a sense. But I suppose it was from observing women in supermarkets talking, and John and I just imagined them not so much talking about perhaps what they were talking about, which was most likely about the latest washing powder or whatever, but talking about, say, French philosophers or... And to transpose different kind, to have them talking about logic, for instance, was a startling thing we felt. And anyway, began to quite enjoy those characters because they were so far removed from our own selves, and obviously in dress too, one was taking a bit of a liberty, and that meant that you yourself were freer to say what you wanted. Somehow it liberated yourself. You were so far removed from being yourself that. You could more easily perhaps say what came into your head straight off, and that's frequently how those characters were written.
How do you get the voice?
Well, with a slight difficulty, but not a great deal.
Were your sketches when you started with Monty Python considered too risque or too eccentric? Did you have any trouble with it?
Well, the BBC, to begin with, didn't like us very much, which was actually strangely in our favour, because they put us out at a very unpopular hour of the evening, late on a Sunday night, which is not a top slot in Britain. Also, they frequently preempted us with important things like horse show jumping. They generally didn't rate us very highly, which was good because that meant they didn't even bother to read the scripts. So that meant we could do more or less as we wanted. It wasn't until towards the end of the second series of programmes that they began to realise that we were picking up quite an audience. And then, of course, they began to read the scripts, and that did lead to one or two problems. But we had then a sort of precedent to point to. We could say, but we said that in programme 3 or whatever, and they would listen to it and found out that we had, and they had no complaints. And so, you know, we could say, we can say it again then.
Several of you, I think, had started writing for a David Frost show before you formed your own program.
That's where five of us really worked for the first time together.
Is that a spoof of the news?
Well, no, it was a topical-ish sketch show. At least they tried to make it sound topical, although, in fact, really, it was just a sketch show in disguise.
Did you think of yourselves as really departing from all your predecessors who did comedy on the BBC?
Well, we wanted to do something new. I think we were both, John and I, talking about now, particularly influenced earlier in our lives by a radio show called The Goon Show, which was a kind of anarchic radio comedy. And that broke new ground in radio, and also, incidentally, the BBC didn't like that programme very much either. They were similar to us in that respect, and they found it awkward to live with. And it frequently poked fun at the BBC too, which we certainly did as well, and had reason to. Censorship-wise, no huge problems, really. As I was saying, I mean, there were one or two examples, but I mean, naughty words, really, just silly, childish, naughty words that they would find objectionable, I suppose, because they probably had a problem with their early toilet training, the BBC.
That must be it.
Yes, I think so. Found sensitive areas.
My guest is comic Graham Chapman. If you're just joining us, he was one of the founding members of Monty Python's Flying Circus. You have been a gay rights activist and, I think, edited a gay paper, gay journal.
No, I didn't
edit
it. What I did really was just to provide them with a little bit of cash in the early days so that they could get a newspaper started. There was a kind of collective which formed a newspaper called Gay News, and that ran for about 10 years until it finally sort of broke up, largely because of new ownership and problems with the old editor wanting too much money, I think. But it's kind of spawned a lot of other papers from it.
Were you out when you helped form Monty Python?
Yes. That was some time before that. I mean, it happened at a time also when I decided to veer away from medicine and go into comedy. My life sort of changed at that point, at the age of about 26. I'd finished at medical school, I'd qualified, I went off to a Mediterranean island to write a movie script with John Cleese, and we were going to be there for 3 months. And at that point, I suppose I began to behave in a more natural way for myself than I had previously. I'd been rather hidebound by convention, pretty conventional upbringing. Certainly, medical schools on the whole are pretty conventional, or they certainly were in terms of their attitude towards sexual matters. Not a place to consider coming out, for instance, really. Although I think things are a little better in that direction now. And at that point, I suppose I felt, okay, I'm leaving medicine alone. There was one part of me which felt that I was doing medicine in the first place, perhaps because it would be of some use to other people. A little bit of guilt about that. I thought, well, then perhaps I can do something for people who are gay and who feel isolated. People used, after all, to commit suicide for that reason, almost that reason alone, to let them know that there were other people like that. It wasn't an unnatural condition. In fact, it's could be considered quite natural if you look at the rest of the animal kingdom in a biological sense. Yes, it's there. It probably serves some function, even, that we don't really know yet. I also actually really don't like labels too much. It sort of pins things down, pigeonholes people rather too much. I would rather not have someone labelled homosexual or heterosexual. I think there's a continuous spectrum which also changes throughout life as well, or should be able to.
The group was comfortable with you coming out publicly? Because I know there was a time in show business, John, where it wasn't much better than in med school.
John Cleese was rather surprised, to say the least. In fact, I think I mentioned it to his girlfriend first, who she was happy about it, but John was rather surprised. I think Jonathan Miller summed that up, John surprised, by saying that he thought it was a bit unfair of me. After all, I was a pipe-smoking, rugby-playing mountaineer, not the obvious sort of gay person, I suppose. So it was a surprise for him. I think he understood in the end.
Mm. In Monty Python, there's been a lot of jokes about real macho men like the lumberjack, who likes to wear a bra and panties and dress up in women's clothes and hang out at the bar. Maybe you remember the lyrics better than I do to that.
Well, Michael Payne and Terry Jones wrote that, so I don't remember them terribly well. He wished he'd been a girly, just like his dear mama, that one.
But there's a lot of jokes about men cross-dressing and so on. And I never knew whether that was jokes written by gay men or whether I should interpret them as homophobic jokes or just British traditional humor.
No, they're not homophobic. They're very sympathetic, I think. We found at that time in Britain, but by using those words openly on our comedy show, that those words in classrooms, and we heard this from teachers, were used openly for the first time without eliciting a sort of snigger or a ridiculous, embarrassed response. And I think that helped to bring things out in the open, to air them a little so that they weren't just hidden away.
I want to play a sketch that I think is really funny, and you initiate this sketch as the colonel, and you're doing the transition here from one sketch to another, and I think this is about what we're talking about, which is a sketch that takes off on macho men who are really who are really gay. So you want to give this a listen?
Yes, why not?
Okay. And my guest, if you're just joining us, is Graham Chapman, one of the founding members of Monty Python.
Right. Now let's see something decent and military. Some precision drilling.
Squad! Camp it! Up!
Who did her? Whoops! I've got your number, Jack. You couldn't afford me, dear 2-3. I'll scratch your eyes out. Don't come the brigadier bit with us, dear. We all know where you've been, you military fairy.
2-3, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Whoops! Don't look now, girls. The major's just minced in with a dolly colour sergeant.
2-3.
Ooh!
Right, stop that. Silly. And a bit suspect, I think.
It's even funnier when you get to see it because all the men in military uniforms are flouncing around and doing step kick while they're performing their drill.
It does look extraordinary, doesn't it? Mm.
Who came up with the idea for that sketch?
That was me.
That was you?
Yes, yeah.
And what kind of reaction did you get to it?
Well, I don't think I've ever noticed any particular reaction to it. There again, I think it's sort of airing, giving an airing to a feeling, to an idea of gay men too. I mean, they're not all like that. For instance, that's a particular type of extroverted gay that existed most particularly in a day when that was repressed, you know, and they just went to an extreme and so behaved in a what you would call they were called screamers, I suppose you would call them, yes, in those days. Less of that now, fortunately.
There's never been any that I know of women in the group.
Well, there was Carol Cleveland, who used to play the female roles when we needed a real female.
Was it more fun to have the men play the women than get women in the group?
Not so much the fun. It was cheaper. That was the most important factor. There were just six of us involved with the program, writing it and performing it on the whole. And the BBC, as I said before, didn't like us very much. They didn't give us a very large budget. So we had to try and keep casting down to a minimum. We played, therefore, as many roles as we could ourselves.
A lot of the men in the group dressed in drag for certain roles.
Yes, which is actually not all that unusual in Britain, certainly. I mean, a long tradition of it going right back to Shakespeare and so on, so it didn't seem like anything particularly extraordinary.
Did people interpret that as being gay humor at all, to have men in drag?
It worried people in the States a little bit to begin with. I think there's a certain sensitivity because, of course, the United States male on the whole is very much more bothered about whether he's being butch enough and macho enough, you know. There's less of, I think, people are a bit more relaxed about that sort of thing in Europe, really. They're not so worried about their masculinity because they know it's there, so they don't have to prove it all the time.
My guest is Graham Chapman. He's a founding member of Monty Python's Flying Circus. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in a couple of seconds.
Okay.
This is Fresh Air. Graham Chapman, I know there was a period, and you've written about this in your autobiography, I know, where you were having problems with alcohol, and then you gave it up.
Mm-hmm.
How much did that affect your career while you were drinking? What period was it?
Well, that was towards the end of the television series, And I actually gave up shortly after filming The Holy Grail, Monty Python and the Holy Grail. In fact, it was the very first day of filming Monty Python and the Holy Grail that I decided that I should stop drinking. And at that point, I'd reached a ridiculous intake per day. I mean, something like 60 fluid ounces of gin, which is monstrous. And prior to that, it was a kind of rock and roll lifestyle that I was leading, I suppose. I drank a lot with my dear friend at the time, Keith Moon, who died shortly after I'd given up drinking. I'd watched him dry out a couple of times, knew that I would have to go through that process as well, but at some point, if I ever was going to stop. But on the first day of shooting of Holy Grail, we were out on a Scottish mountainside at 7 o'clock in the morning, and it was wet and cold, and I hadn't come prepared with any alcohol. I hadn't got a hip flask or anything. The nearest village was 20 miles away, and there were no trucks available because the camera broke down, so they were all running around trying to get another part for the camera. And I had we started shooting 1.5 hours late. By then I was going through DTs, really, shivering a lot, shaking, feeling pretty nauseous and nasty. And I had the scene to do as King Arthur, where he crosses the bridge of death over the gorge of eternal peril. Well, that sort of rang big bells. That suggested to me something. I felt, this isn't fair to the others, it's not fair to me. Wait a minute, it's not fair to me, that is stupid. I will stop. But couldn't stop immediately then, because I had the film to make. I couldn't afford the time or neither could the film, for me to go through the drying out process. So I kept myself topped up to a reasonable level for me then, which would have been appalling for anyone else, I think. But and then 2 months after, roughly, after we'd finished filming, I gave up at Christmas time.
It must have been really hard to go through the withdrawal. I think you went through it cold turkey on your own?
Yes, I did. It's not wise to do it on your own. But I suppose I wanted to do it that way. You know, it's part of in a way to... I needed to do it myself. Now, I think it's everyone has to make the decision themselves. If a person doesn't feel that they want to stop, then it's very difficult to stop them. You know, you can't really. They have to make that decision themselves. I had made that decision, and that was the only difficult thing, really. That actually, the withdrawal period, okay, that was sort of unpleasant physically a bit, but, I mean, quite bearable. And... The rest was pretty easy. One just got better and better, and found that I was able to do things that I hadn't been able to do well for some time, very easily, like turn up on time for things and learn lines and act.
Yeah, had that
became,
been affect-
became a very simple matter.
Had that been affecting the kind of roles that you were getting?
Well, it may have, but not a lot, I don't think. I was pretty good at covering up, and I don't think the other members of the group realised quite how much I was drinking.
Mm. You're in America as we speak, touring at various clubs and I suppose colleges as well.
Mm.
I know that because of your popularity in America, you must be pretty aware of American humor. I think that there's a lot of British humor and Monty Python type humor that a lot of Americans don't necessarily get because the language is so different.
Yes, I suppose there are. Although we were quite fortunate in that respect in that during the whole TV series, we tended not, on the whole, to use topical humour, and also, on the whole, not really to mention or take off characters of the time, political figures and so on. If they were mentioned, then it was just generic. It was just that they were an example of a breed, not necessarily to indicate that particular person. So that has meant that it is relatively timeless, at least, although there obviously are one or two specific things that will be pretty meaningless now. And also, because of the area and where we were filming or where we were performing these sketches, and also because of the location sometimes, and the local dialects, things might be at first pretty meaningless to an American audience, we imagine, certainly. But they seem to pick up on it, and to persist and indeed find translations if they can't understand them first off.
Well, I think one of my favorite sketches is Spam, the Spam song.
Oh, yes.
And, of course, I'd never, as an American, eaten Spam. I think they actually sell it in many of the supermarkets, but I think of it as being a very English.
Well, it isn't. I thought it was always made here.
Is it really?
It's something we got given during the war.
People are nodding to me, I think.
It was shipped over to Britain to feed us during the war, you see.
So we Americans are responsible for this.
Yes, and it's its 50th birthday this very year.
Did you write the Spam song by any chance?
No, that was Mike and Terry. Yeah. Mm.
Okay. You had studied to be a doctor.
Yes.
And gave that up to become a comic?
Mm-hmm.
Ever wish it was the other way around?
No, I mean, medicine is now a very good hobby of mine. But I guess I went towards medicine because of family background and so on. My brother was aiming in that direction too. He's now a surgeon. He's 4 years older than me. And it was easier to go along that path than to take a rather more dramatic and less secure kind of direction in terms of writing and acting. It seemed almost an impossibility from the point of view of... my parents, at least. That's what I always wanted to do, though. That was in my subconscious. I didn't allow that to surface until I arrived at Cambridge University, met John Cleese there. We began writing together and doing little bits of cabaret and eventually, even while at college, writing for TV. That carried on after I was at doing my clinical studies at St. Bartholomew's Hospital. And in fact wrote with John for two whole series of programs, TV programs, during that period.
Are you still collaborating with John Cleese now?
Yes, I mean, it's been some 27 years now, on and off. I mean, there have been huge patches where we've been doing other things individually. But, yeah.
So are there more movies in the works?
Well, there's nothing in the works at the moment as a group. No, we're all doing our own individual things. I think we're all optimistic that there will be another movie at some point, though when, we don't know. Last time I spoke to John Cleese, he said, well, maybe when we're about 50, which isn't long now in his case, certainly. So, yes, I think we are optimistic about it. But the difficult thing is getting six people to agree on a subject. It really is quite tricky.
Well, what's your collaborating method when you are working together?
Well, John and I wrote together. Michael Payne and Terry Jones wrote together. Eric wrote on his own, and then Terry Gilliam did all the animations and the visual side of things.
So would you lock yourself up in a room and try to write sketches together?
Yeah, well, John and I would just meet up and sit there for an hour or so, trying to avoid work at all costs, drinking cups of coffee and reading the newspapers, talking about what was in the news, maybe anything to put off that awful moment of having to put something on paper. And then about an hour before lunchtime, we'd begin to feel guilty that we hadn't done anything, and at that point we would hopefully think of something which had either occurred during that first hour or so, or if not, then in desperation open up Roger's thesaurus and simply look at a collection of words to see if that inspired anything, which it sometimes did.
I'll bet it did, because so many of your sketches were wordplay, and it wasn't logical, but it was hysterical.
Look at the cheese shop sketch, for instance.
Oh, and the cheese
almost
dancing.
almost directly from Roger's thesaurus.
What did you look up that led to that?
Well, we were into cheeses anyway, so we simply looked at that point. We liked the idea of a shop which contained absolutely nothing that it claimed it sold, which is just a minor exaggeration of the way some British shops are. So that was what we were getting at, I think, and decided on cheese as being the comestible in point, and so just looked up a whole list of cheeses in Roger, added a few, and there it was. It took about 2 minutes to write, I think, in the end.
When you're a comic writer and you're writing with a collaborator, do you laugh at each other's funny lines?
Yes, and also laugh together, too. I mean, there's one whole sketch when John and I, we perhaps had gone a bit too far, but we felt guilty about it while we were writing it, which made us laugh hysterically. And that was the Undertaker's sketch. I mean, perhaps we had gone too far. You know, people taking their dead mothers into Undertakers in a sack, you know, it's on sort of tricky ground, isn't it?
And then they had to decide if they were going to burn them,
bury them, or dump them.
Yes.
That made us feel guilty, I suppose, because all the time we were thinking of our own dear mothers, and it is a bit far to go, isn't it?
Well, this is a real serious issue, I think. If you're writing humor like that, do you want your mother to hear it?
No, you don't. Fortunately, with John and I, we did frequently, I suppose, really think of our own mothers when we were writing sketches. John always used the excuse that it was my mother, and I always used the excuse that it was his. And they seem to believe that quite satisfactorily.
Your mothers believe that?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I'm really sorry that we're out of time. I've really enjoyed meeting you, and I thank you.
Thank you.
Very much for talking with us. My guest has been Graham Chapman, who's a founding member of Monty Python's Flying Circus, and he's now an author and film producer as well as a comic and actor. This is Fresh Air.